KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Thousands of U.S. Forest Service workers were fired in recent weeks, part of the Trump administration's efforts to shrink the federal government. A federal board this week ordered the U.S. Department of Agriculture to rehire those it fired. Before this development, Grist and IPR's Izzy Ross spoke to one of those workers.
Marie Richards is a citizen of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians. A little over a year ago, she joined the Forest Service as a tribal relations specialist in northern Michigan.
The congressional boundaries of any forest, and there's actually what the forests own and manage within it. But you'll pass right by it on your way to 115.
Yeah, see, I'm still doing my job and I don't even work there. That's how much I loved it.
That change was sudden. Richards got a phone call from her supervisor on a Saturday in mid-February, telling her she'd been let go.
I hung up the phone and I think I screamed, and my neighbor may or may not have heard me scream. I don't have the heart to ask him.
Richards was one of thousands of probationary workers targeted for layoffs as part of the Trump administration's efforts to cut costs and shrink the federal government.
None of us deserved this. We all work hard. We all work hard and we're dedicated because we're taking care of the land.
That land includes almost 1 million acres and two treaty territories. Tribal nations ceded that to the federal government, which has a responsibility to keep it in trust for indigenous peoples. As a liaison, Richards was part of that. As a tribal citizen, the work was also personal. She worries about what will happen to that trust responsibility as people like her are laid off.
That's a promise. That's an agreement between the federal government and tribal nations that there are things. We have treaty rights, and without the people doing the work to take care of the land, where is that? Mm-hmm. Where is that? We have to have the public trust to also have tribal trust.
Richards isn't sure what's next for her. But one thing that is certain is her desire to keep doing work with tribes and heritage.
That was Izzy Ross speaking with Marie Richards. As of Thursday, Richards had yet to be reinstated. This weekend, AMC's crime thriller Dark Winds, based on Tony Hillerman novels, begins its third season. Brian Bull has this preview.
We all have a line that runs down the middle of our heart. That line separates monsters from men.
The new episodes find Navajo Tribal Police Lieutenant Joe Leaphorn wrestling with his conscience following his actions last season. Actor Zahn McLernan.
You know, he struggles with guilt, that moral gray area he's kind of found himself in, questions his decisions, his moral compass, and what choices, how they may have cost him. It just puts him into a lot of fear and anxiety this season.
Kiowa Gordon plays Jim Chi. He says this season finds the ex-FBI agent trying to gain acceptance back into the Navajo community and reconcile with a childhood tormentor who suspected in a boy's death.
He has a chance to confront his demon, so to speak, you know, which is like a Shorty Bowlegs. He's trying to figure out if this guy is actually a murderer to this child.
Dark Winds has already been greenlit for a fourth season. Showrunner Joe Wirth says the cast and crew are all dedicated to making the show authentic and respectful of Native culture.
Without denigrating Hillerman's accomplishments or his work at all, I have a sense that he took the Navajo story and told it through his own lens. But I think it was somewhat off-putting for indigenous people who were reading that stuff. What I really wanted to do on this TV show was reappropriate the stories back to the Navajo people.
The season 3 premiere of Dark Winds is Sunday on AMC. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
See Renewal's expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. See Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com.
Support by DT Track, your healthcare partner, providing access to a nationwide network of qualified healthcare temporary staff, including medical billing professionals that optimize your revenue cycles. DT Track will be at the Reservation Economic Summit, booth 214.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
We want to ensure that there's an ability to provide a payment to the state of Alaska each and every year. We don't want to have a 46% probability of failure.
Permanent fund managers sound the alarm over the fund's future. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 7th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, state leaders applaud President Trump's spotlighting of the Alaska LNG project.
He shouted out Alaska. He shouted out the pipeline concept that we're all working on that he supports. And he doesn't just talk about it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Local sponsors do right by their business and for the community by supporting public media stations. Thank you for considering adding your corporate support. You'll be in good company.
There's a nearly 50-50 chance that the Alaska Permanent Fund won't have enough spendable money to pay dividends and the state's bills at least once over the next decade. That is, unless lawmakers change the structure of the fund to function more like a university endowment. That's the key takeaway from a presentation Permanent Fund leaders and the legislature's chief budget analyst gave to lawmakers this week. Permanent Fund Corporation CEO Devin Mitchell told lawmakers on Tuesday that the issue is not with the $80-plus billion Permanent Fund itself. Mitchell says the problem is with the fund's two-account structure.
We want to ensure that there's an ability to provide a payment to the state of Alaska each and every year. We don't want to have a 46% probability of failure. We don't want to have any probability of failure for this revenue stream at this point.
The permanent fund is separated into two accounts. There's the nearly $60 billion so-called principal, which can't be spent without a vote of the people. And then there's the so-called earnings reserve account, which has about $9 billion in spendable money. Legislators could spend every last dollar of that by a simple majority vote. Now, lawmakers are considering a constitutional amendment that would combine the two accounts into one. Legislative budget analysts say that would solve the problem. The amendment would also constitutionally cap the draw at 5%, creating what the Permanent Fund's board chair describes as, quote, predictability and sustainability for the fund going forward. Senator Bert Stedman, a Sitka Republican, says the amendment would also prevent lawmakers from spending billions of dollars from the fund when they face a deficit.
The little piggies in the trough are getting hungry in this building, so let's not, you know, overlook the benefit of the endowment concept in restricting the ability of appropriations over if it's a 5% or 4.5%, whatever we set that limit at.
The Permanent Funds Board has been pushing to combine the accounts for decades. Last year, they published a rare analysis paper illustrating the importance of the concept. Combining the accounts and capping the draw is broadly popular among senators in both the largely Democratic majority and the all-Republican minority, though there is some debate about whether 5% is the right amount to draw every year. Placing a constitutional amendment on the ballot for voters takes a two-thirds majority in the House and Senate, and the governor would not be able to veto it. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump voiced his support for a long-discussed but unbuilt Alaska LNG project on Tuesday during his first address to Congress since taking office in January. But as KDLL's Ashlyn O'Hara reports, the project still faces some major hurdles.
President Donald Trump's mention of the Alaska LNG energy project came about 22 minutes into Tuesday's speech.
My administration is also working on a gigantic natural gas pipeline in Alaska, among the largest in the world, where Japan, South Korea, and other nations want to be our partner with investments of trillions of dollars each. There's never been anything like that one. It will be truly spectacular. It's all set to go. The permitting is gotten.
That proposed pipeline would send natural gas from Alaska's North Slope, 800 miles south to Nikiski on the Kenai Peninsula. From there, it would get cooled to a liquid state and exported overseas. Trump's address to Congress wasn't the first or even the second time he's touted the pipeline since taking office, and he supported the project during his first term, too. But different versions of the project have been discussed in Alaska for decades, and there are long-standing questions about how it would pencil out. Some claims made Tuesday also don't match up with the current reality of the project. Foreign support, for instance, has ebbed and flowed over the last decade. And as of Wednesday, there aren't any binding agreements with anyone to buy gas from the project if it's built. A spokesperson for the state development agency that currently owns the project, the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, said via email that Trump's comment about trillions from Japan and Korea could refer to future purchases of liquefied natural gas from Alaska, but no purchase agreements exist at this time. As for Trump's claims on permitting, the project received the bulk of its permits from federal regulators in 2020, which the corporation says it's kept up to speed.
If there's any additional work efforts that are being asked of us by the agencies, we're providing that. When we take a final investment decision, we're able to move forward.
That's Frank Richards, president of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. Some of the project's existing federal permits have expiration dates. But Richard says the corporation can apply for extensions as long as it shows the project is being advanced. It's also unclear who exactly is going to pay to build the project. Its current price tag is $44 billion. A study commissioned by state lawmakers last year estimates $11 billion for the pipeline alone. Late last year, the project did get a $50 million pledge from state developers to minimize the financial risk to whatever company decides to take on the work of updating the project's engineering and design cost estimates. Republican U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan was quick to celebrate Trump's comments Tuesday. He recorded a video from the Senate subway after the address.
People have always been naysayers. We're not there yet, but when you have a federal government starting with the president who wants to get this done, who wants to put it out there to the American people. Governor Dunleavy and I worked this really hard to encourage the president and his team to put it in the State of the Union. They did. That was a huge win for us. We're going to keep working this.
According to Sullivan's office, he personally pitched the project to Trump in January. Dunleavy published his own video on social media thanking Trump for his comments on Wednesday evening.
He loves Alaska. He literally said he loves Alaska in this speech. He shouted out Alaska. He shouted out the pipeline concept that we're all working on that he supports. And he doesn't just talk about it. He has directed his secretaries to make sure that this pipeline gets done.
When asked what type of direction Dunleavy was aware of Trump giving to his secretaries, a spokesperson for his office said the governor's statement, quote, is what it is. He directed further questions to the White House, which did not respond to a request for comment. Reporting in Kenai, I'm Ashlyn O'Hara.
Leaders at Anchorage's Keystone Homelessness Nonprofit are raising the alarm over what they describe as an affordable housing emergency. Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness Executive Director Meg Zalatel says her organization recently announced a program to provide rental assistance to community members. They received hundreds of responses in just 2.5 days.
1,300 households said they were either 14 days from losing their housing or already experiencing homelessness. That's shocking, quite frankly. Those households, 808 of them, have a child.
Zalatel says the need is likely much higher and speculates that they would have seen more demand if they'd opened the application period for longer. She says the city's homeless response system is at capacity, with shelters and transitional housing programs full and roughly 500 people currently on the streets.
Family shelter capacity diminishes significantly during the summer. So if 808 households have a child, are we going to see families on the streets of Anchorage this summer? I don't know, but I don't want us to be surprised by it.
Zalatel says another reason the need to bolster housing assistance is vital and timely is due to a number of cascading community impacts on the horizon.
This number is before federal layoffs, before possible layoffs from ASD based on their budget, before economic impacts due to tariffs, before rising food costs, before slowdowns in SNAP or anything else.
Zalatel says she doesn't know the best way to address the looming affordable housing crisis, but she's hopeful that the dire nature of the nonprofit's data will help spur community members and government bodies to come together to work on a solution. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, rural Alaska educators say the state's lack of infrastructure support is creating a crisis.
Please go visit our schools. Come out to the rural areas, take a look at the leaking roof and the ponds and the paths that are underneath it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station. The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
Two men are missing and presumed dead after an all-terrain vehicle went through ice yesterday on a river in the Matanuska-Susitna borough. Alaska State Trooper spokeswoman Tess Williams says five people were on the side-by-side ATV that went into the Susitna River just before 9 a.m. Thursday. The group was doing work for Alaska Directional Drilling and another contractor.
Three of those people were able to get out of the water, but two were reported to have gone under the ice in the current.
The survivors walked to a nearby work camp where they were picked up by a chartered helicopter. None required medical attention. A trooper helicopter and a state plane flew to the area Thursday but couldn't find the missing men. More aircraft were in the area today, continuing a search Williams says is too dangerous to be done on the ground.
The ice in the area is very unstable. It's unsafe at this point for any of our rescuers or any rescue operations in general to go out on that ice or to search that way.
The search comes during an unseasonably warm winter in Alaska, which has affected everything from the state's wildfire season to traditional sports like the Iditarod Trail sled dog race. Williams says Thursday's incident carries important safety messages for Alaskans.
Snow and ice conditions around Alaska and South Central right now are definitely not great. The ice is just not a safe place to be. It's important for people to check conditions, thickness, and things like that before you go out on the ice.
Williams didn't have word today on how long the search will continue. As part of ProPublica's local reporting network, KYUK senior reporter Emily Schwing spent the last year crawling through attics, basements, gear closets, and classrooms in rural public schools across the state. She found chemical leaks, standing raw sewage, extensive black mold, exposed electrical wiring, and malfunctioning fire alarms. For years, school districts statewide have submitted hundreds of millions of dollars in requests for help with construction and maintenance. And for years, Alaska's lawmakers haven't been able to fund those needs. Now, the state's rural school districts are facing a public health and safety crisis.
Alaska's legislature and the governor are divided over education funding. And this year, most of the debate centers around the BSA, the base student allocation. This is the amount of money the state's willing to put toward each individual student. It pays for things like textbooks and teachers' salaries. For Kay Andrews, this debate overlooks something else.
Please go visit our schools. Come out to the rural areas. Take a look at the leaking roof and the ponds and the paths that are underneath it. And we don't have space for other students.
Andrews is school board president of the Bristol Bay Area's Southwest Region School District. Increasing the BSA won't help cover what she's talking about. Money to fix things like failing heating systems, malfunctioning fire alarms, and broken sewer lines isn't supposed to come from the BSA. In February, the Senate and House Education Committees heard from Andrews and several others from rural Alaska who testified about the serious public health and safety risks they face inside the state's public school buildings.
Hello. My name is Angela Medellina. My Inupiaq name is Kimisuk. I'm a junior representative at Nome Belts High School. Sitting in my English class, there's a giant bucket of oil right next to me and my peers. Not only is it in my English class, but it's also in the hallways. And it's scary to look at.
Hello, my name is Tegan Taylor, and I am the student representative for Southeast Island School District on Prince of Wales Island. We also face serious challenges. Our heating systems are failing.
Money to fix infrastructure problems comes from the state's capital budget. Kuskokwim School District includes nine schools nestled along the banks of the upper Kuskokwim River. Superintendent Madeline Aguillard's been outspoken about what those schools need in order to operate safely for students and teachers.
We have multiple schools in dire need of help. And we definitely recognize that our neighboring districts as well have these exact same needs. You know, the buildings are very similar in age, the conditions are similar, and the maintenance ability, the preventative maintenance abilities and the capacity issues, those are all things that rural districts have in common.
Many of Alaska's rural school districts serve unincorporated communities. This means they have no tax base to help pay for public schools. And there's no local government that can levy taxes to help with maintenance or construction. Alaska Senator Lukey Gale Tobin, a Democrat representing Anchorage, chairs the Senate Education Committee.
The current deferred maintenance backlog in school construction is beyond crisis levels. I think the way public education is supported by the state government is embarrassing at best.
Each year, superintendents and maintenance directors have to apply for construction and maintenance funds. Those applications are submitted to the state education department. Hundreds of proposals from both rural and urban school districts are ranked. And then that list is submitted to lawmakers so they can understand the needs as they decide how to fund the state's annual budget. This year, requests from rural school districts to the state's construction and maintenance program stand at nearly $478 million. State records show that over the last 25 years, rural school districts have submitted nearly 1,800 funding requests for capital projects, fixes, and improvements to their buildings. Only about 14% of those projects have been funded. Madeline Aguillard says that without capital investment from the state, rural school administrators have to pull money away from their main mission, educating kids, in order to ensure that classrooms are safe.
You know, when districts are talking about, you know, having to maybe not schedule, say, a Japanese 3 course or I can't even think of some of these elective courses because it blows my mind. Like, our kids would love it.
For two decades, the roof of the school in Sleetmute has been leaking. The school district has asked the state 19 times for money to fix it. Over time, that leak has led to extensive structural damage. In January, Governor Mike Dunleavy introduced his proposed education bill for the coming year. There's no mention of money that would be specifically earmarked for capital improvements, that is, cash to fix school buildings. Dina Bishop is the commissioner of the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. She delivered status reports to lawmakers in January as well.
There's just not a lot of mention of these construction and maintenance, capital improvements specifically. Why do you think that is?
I would say because the interest is in and the advocacy by different organizations is always in the operations money, BSA, BSA, and not the other. And that's a good point. Creating advocacy around facilities. Yeah, I could see that.
The majority of students who attend classes in rural public schools across the state are Indigenous. Alaska House Speaker Bryce Edgman, who is also Alaska Native, acknowledges that without an equivalent increase in capital investment, it's unlikely some rural schools will be able to use BSA funds as they're meant to be used. And the state's Indigenous students are likely to feel the greatest impact.
No matter what we would increase the BSA by, it's simply not going to meet the mandate that they basically have to provide a good public education in schools that really don't have any economies of scale, don't have the high number of enrollment to bring in money that's requested. It's beyond daunting. It's overwhelming.
There is a bill in the state house that calls for increasing the base student allocation, but it doesn't mention additional funds specifically meant for construction and maintenance. Alaska faces a looming budget deficit, and the lack of attention to capital investment, the money to pay for construction and maintenance, means in addition to worries about staffing and classes, rural school administrators are left wondering how to clean up persistent chemical leaks, replace phones that no longer work, and fix doors that no longer close. With help from Eric Stone in Juneau, in Anchorage, I'm Emily Schwing.
Support for this reporting comes from ProPublica and the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism's 2024 National Fellowship, its fund for reporting on child well-being, and the Dennis A. Hunt Fund for Health Journalism.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Did you know 100 years ago, the chances of a baby dying in Alaska before their first birthday was almost 10%? Because of advances in public health like sanitation, access to clean water, vaccines for children, and access to healthcare in rural communities, the chances of dying are now less than 1%. To learn more about what the Alaska Department of Health is doing to improve Alaskans' health for the next 100 years, visit health.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Ukrainians who fled the war in their country and sought refuge in America have been worrying whether they'd be allowed to stay in the country ever since Donald Trump was elected president. And Trump's comments Thursday about making a decision soon regarding the Ukrainians' legal status here has heightened their fears. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Svetlana Kravitz says the worst part is not knowing what the future will bring.
Because of the uncertainty, they don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Kravitz is a first-generation Ukrainian-American whose family came to the United States in the 1990s and to Delta Junction about 25 years ago. She now works with Catholic Social Services, helping a new cohort of 200 Ukrainians find refuge in Delta and Fairbanks. She said nearly all of them want to start a new life here, but due to the uncertainty, they just try to cope one day at a time.
I mean, you can probably imagine you go to a different country, to a different place, and you work there and you live there, and you don't know what tomorrow's going to bring. So a lot of people are thinking, can we buy land and build? Can we buy a house? We can't. We don't know what's going to happen.
On Thursday, Trump heightened their anxiety when he said he's considering revoking authority granted by the Biden administration that allowed nearly a quarter of a million Ukrainians to stay in the United States.
And I'm looking at that, and there were some people that think that's appropriate and some people don't, and I'll be making a decision pretty soon. Okay?
The Reuters news agency, which reported Trump's comments, added that spokespersons for the White House and Department of Homeland Security said no decision has been made yet and that the agency had no new announcements. Kravitz said last week that worst-case scenario is what Ukrainian newcomers are dreading.
Trump might revoke the TPS or the UHP for them, and they'd have to go back.
Those acronyms refer to temporary protected status and Ukrainian humanitarian parole, which are two of the programs that authorize the newcomers to live in the United States. About 2,000 of them are in Alaska, and Catholic Social Services State Refugee Coordinator Issa Spatrizano says the organization serves 750 of them under the Ukrainian humanitarian parole program.
For individuals who are here that arrived at the Uniting for Ukraine, they're on humanitarian parole status. There is concern around them and their long-term ability to stay.
Spatrizano says all the newcomers share the uncertainty over their future.
Some of these Ukrainians have been in our state for the last 3 years, you know, and they've got jobs and they have community. And some of them were looking at going back to the university or looking at buying homes or other things. And so there's a real hesitancy to move forward with those sorts of laying down your roots if you're not sure what your future holds.
She says most of the newcomers are working and supporting their families, but there's concern that the Trump administration may revoke their authorization to work. And she says thinking about the war-torn country they'd be sent back to elevates that concern.
Ukraine is still a war zone. For many people, returning home would be returning home to nothing. Potentially the places where they lived have been bombed, destroyed, their school's gone, their home's gone.
Ukrainian newcomers in Delta declined to comment for this story, and Spatrizano says it's not surprising they don't want to say anything that might make things worse for them.
I think people can understand that feeling, and that's certainly a feeling that the Ukrainian community is having right now.
Kravitz says a couple of families that were living in Delta have returned to Ukraine, and so have an unknown number of young men who've gone back to help defend against Russian invaders. She says those who remain are trying to deal with their worries by focusing on their families and their jobs, and they're calling on a higher power for comfort.
We're just keeping your fingers crossed, and people are praying, so God gives them wisdom, and it all works out for the good.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Iditarod sled dog race teams at the head of the pack are wrapping up their mandatory 24-hour breaks at checkpoints along the trail today, including the one in Galena. As the Alaska Desk's Shelby Herbert reports, mushers say they battled the Sandman and an actual sandstorm out on the trail.
Mushers at the Galena checkpoint, almost 400 miles into the trail, are visibly weary, with dark circles under their eyes and a shuffling gait. In the early hours of the morning, they listlessly file through the checkpoint's coffee station before heading out into the cold to begin their dog chores. But musher Laura Eklund of Two Rivers says, at some point, caffeine just ceases to work.
Now, there's moments when you're kind of getting a little loopy and whatnot, and it's just kind of one of those deals where almost kind of will yourself to stay awake. Eating something, a lot of times brushing your teeth helps kick your body into being awake. And
2023 Iditarod champion Ryan Reddington of Knik says he'll just give in to the fatigue every so often. He'll zonk out on the back of his sled for short spells, trusting his dogs to take him where they need to go.
I take a little naps here and there, just, you know, let a bump wake me up, and most of the time it works out really well. Last year, I paid the price. I fell off my sled, so this year I tied myself down.
Reddington says when he took that big spill last year, his dogs decided to leave him in the dust.
You know, I asked them to stop, and they all looked back at me, and then they just picked up the pace.
He had to hitch a ride with another musher to catch up with them, and only managed to do so after his empty sled overturned. Gabe Dunham says she trains hard in the off-season for the long, sleepless race nights. She's well-equipped to fight off the exhaustion, having packed out heaps of buffet food from a Safeway grocery store to keep herself comfortable and energized. But this week, a sandstorm on an earlier section of trail was no comfort to her tired eyes. A strong wind kicked up the silt on the surface of melting Tanana riverbeds, blowing it straight into her and her dog's faces.
You could see this wall of wind and sand. Like, it just looked like a dark cloud, really. So we stopped outside of it, and I pulled my parka out, even though it was like 35 above, and I put that on just for wind protection. So the dogs handled it remarkably well.
The mushers are looking forward to firmer snow and colder temperatures on the next leg of the trail. From Galena, they head to Nulato, then Caltag, and loop down to Anvik and back before racing to the Bering Sea coast. Reporting in Galena, I'm Shelby Herbert.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Ashlyn O'Hara in Kenai, Chris Clint and Emily Schwing in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, and Shelby Herbert in Galena. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Annie Fight produced tonight's show. And I'm Wesley Early. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Public media loves being part of your day. Thank you for listening and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media. Yeah, baby.
Come alive, come alive, fall down. Exit the door where you don't know me. Invisible to you.
She wanna drive my Benz with five of her friends. She wanna creep past the block, spying again. She wanna roll with Jay, chase skios away. She wanna fight with lame chicks, blow my day. She wanna respect the rest, kick me to the curb. If she find one strand of hair longer than her, she wanna
up in the jacuzzi,
rub up in the movies,
access to the old crib, keys to the new.
She wanna answer the phone, tattoo her arm. That's when I gotta send her back to her mom. She called me heartbreaker. When we apart, it makes her want a piece of paper. Scribble down, I hate ya. But she knows she love Jay because she love everything Jay say Jay does. And
I'm
Baby, Get you off, cause I'm ready and equipped now. Swing for me, baby, give me all that you got. Never wanna stop, cause you make me feel hot. I know what you wanna do, and that I feel the same way too. Give you what you want through the days and the nights. Yeah, it's about time that we turned out the lights.
Excuse me, can I please talk to you for a minute? Sure, you know, you look kind of familiar. Wanted to know, do you know somebody named? You know his name.
Oh yeah, definitely. I know his name.
But I just want to let you know that he's mine.
No, he's mine.